Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today it's great to chat with Locke Kelly on the podcast. Locke is an author, meditation teacher, psychotherapist, and founder of the nonprofit Open Hearted Awareness Institute. Locke teaches in a non-sectarian human being lineage using an adult education style based in the earliest non-dual wisdom traditions, modern science, and psychotherapy. Locke's work is to help people access awakening as the next natural stage of human development. He offers in-person retreats, workshops, and online video and audio courses, and he has served on the New York Insight Teachers Council. Locke, I'm so glad we can finally make time to chat today.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. This is really fun. Looking forward.
Yeah, me too. There's lots of different avenues to go with this, but I thought we could start if you could just offer our listeners a little bit about your own background and some of your maybe most seminal teachers in this path that you've been on.
Yeah, well, in some ways, I'm really similar to Maslow. I've been trying to put together the science and the psychology, and then wondering what these peak experiences are, what these spiritual experiences are. They spiritual? Are they consciousness experience? So early on from childhood, I would have these what I call glimpses, or I would start by saying maybe what I call now peak experiences. I call them P-E-E-K. So they're actually peaks into what's already here and what's already awake and already who I've always been.
Yeah. I really like that.
So I would have them in sports. I would have them in nature. I would have them, after kind of an intense emotional experience of loss or. And so it just led me to feel like, okay, so this is so interesting. Why isn't everyone talking about this? So I thought, well, I guess I can find out more. And it led me after going and teaching. I taught high school for a couple of years after college and then went to graduate school at Columbia University with a joint degree program in clinical social work and comparative religion. And I went off on a fellowship to Sri Lanka, India, and Nepal, and did a long period of study at a university there, and then up in the monasteries, and then sat, you know, bunch of 10-day retreats and 21-day retreat and 5-day retreats, and you know, really got a good in-depth experience of kind of the Theravada insight meditation Vipassana tradition. And then I went up north and ended up with a teacher in the Tibetan tradition whose name was Toku Urgen Rinpoche, and going up to his hut in the Himalayas, and then, you know, giving a little talk, and then within 3 minutes of his pointing out instruction, I felt the same way I did at the end of a 10-day retreat.
Wow, that's exciting. Wow.
Yeah, and the same teacher, Sam Harris, studied with him as well. You know, having had this experience of meditation and studying the tradition, and then getting this immediate shift, you know, what could be called, is it a peak experience or is it a PEAK experience or is it a PEEK? And they were saying, this is already here. You're not creating it. It's not a meditation state. You're actually walking around in a hypnotic state and you're dehypnotizing yourself back to your natural condition, to the nature of mind and the nature of your identity. So with that as the kind of hypothesis, I continued to try these practices there. And that second day, I just had this experience where I was crying and laughing and just feeling like, oh my God, could it be this simple? Could it be this close? Could it be this just awesome and connected? And not only am I calm, but I'm, you know, feel creative and connected to everyone else in the world. It's not just the absence, it's the presence and the fullness of being a full human being, even if I'm having emotions or thoughts. There's just this greater capacity of identity and mind that just made me feel like, okay, whatever this is what I'm going to do with my life, is figure out how to experience this. And then immediately I felt like, and I want to share it with people if I can figure it out. So I,
go ahead.
So I went back, and instead of like joining a monastery there, you know, which was the thought, okay, well, should I do this in depth? But it just felt like, oh, I can do this within minutes anywhere. So let me go back and finish this joint degree. And at that time in New York City, there's a lot of homelessness. And so I started soup kitchens and shelters and worked in psychiatry as a clinical psychiatric social worker, inpatient, and then psych emergency room, and then 5 years outpatient psych. So I got both the kind of wisdom traditions consciousness, and then I worked with people who were Axis One diagnosis clients and started to adapt a kind of what I call effortless mindfulness or non-dual mindfulness version of therapy with all people.
Yeah. Well, that is really cool. There is a dearth of integration between the psychological literature and I don't even know what to call that other world, you know, the mindful, some people would say the woo-woo world, but I don't want to be disrespectful.
that would be the scientist or the psychology world. So I would say the meditative or the
meditative. Yeah,
I think the word I would use is consciousness, because as we'll see when we discuss some of your work and my work, that it's not just about the emotion or the personality or the attitude that we're adjusting, but there we're adjusting the consciousness to which it's all appearing.
Well, this is the thing that's so interesting, because in this, like, I mean, I'm a cognitive scientist, so I'm fascinated with the mind, brain, consciousness. But if you read those journal articles, and then you put that down and you go and listen to even people like you, you know, there's a different lexicon. Yes. There's a different language being used. And, yeah. And I want to map it all. There must be the same phenomenon. It's not like we're talking about different, it's humans or humans. So yeah.
That's right. So we could play with that. I mean, I'm glad one of the words to play with is, you know, the whole realm of self, self and ego, selflessness, self-transcendence, you know, self. So, you know, at some point we, you and I can go through that, and they're very distinct, and it all actually works together. You know, that's one of my, you know, interests was to bring them together and to show that it is human experience, and that when you make those fine distinctions, you're freed of this kind of being caught in a dualistic, like, I've got to get rid of myself. You know, I've got to transcend my ego. You know, that's what transcendence means. I'm beyond it, you know, and you realize, oh no, that's a part of me that's an ego function that thought it was an ego identity. And now there's something greater than that that's aware of that. And then you aren't, you know, it's not an either or.
Well, this is great. Let's build up to it then. Let's take this piece by piece, or else I'll get overwhelmed. I don't know. You probably won't, but I will. Let's take it piecemeal. So you use phrases. Let's even just start with the phrase awake awareness.
Right.
What does that mean?
Okay. So that's now. So we've jumped all the way to the biggest.
Oh, did we? Oh, maybe we shouldn't start there. Then, should we start with local awareness? What do you think we should start with?
Well, so I can start there. So awake awareness is a word that's translated from a Tibetan word rigpa, which means nature of mind. Hmm. And there's a word in Sanskrit called turiya, and it means is translated often as pure awareness. So it means the consciousness prior to a child learning to use words and concepts. So there's a it has a primordial and then a preverbal, just consciousness, and then it has a wisdom dimension that's beyond thought and that is aware of thought. So when you're identified with thought and then you step back to a mindful witness, you're in kind of mindful awareness. But then if you do this non-dual practice, what you do is you actually look to see who's behind that mindful witness, who's behind the camera, and you can open to this feeling of this more spacious, vast awareness that in itself feels alert, but isn't orienting to thought, to know, so that in Buddhism, thinking is considered the sixth sense. So we have our five senses input, and thought is arising like sound, but it's an internal experience arising to who or to what. So it rises to this non-conceptual, alert feeling of just being aware. And you could move your hand from here, or you could use thought, but you don't need to think about it. So
this is really interesting. Yeah, I want to wrap my head fully around this. It's like meditation without a meditator is what it sounds like you're saying. And this is something that's a little bit different than the kind of meditation I learned in like an 8-week MBSR course. Yeah. You know, so let's compare and contrast. I'm such a nerd, but between kind of in the MBSR practice, I've done it twice now. I've taken the MBSR course. It's significantly helped my anxiety. I can definitely say that. And in that kind of practice, we very much focused on returning to the breath, and also there was a bit of open monitoring meditation, which I'd love to see how that maps on to what you're talking about, where this kind of open awareness of sort of whatever arises without trying to grasp for it or hold on to it, just like being really just aware of it. But I feel like what you're describing is something, it's different than all of that. And I really want to wrap my head around that. It's kind of like like tapping into a certain force field of consciousness that's lacking content and concepts, and you're tapping into it in a way that is effortless, and you're not even like attempting to shine your spotlight of attention on it. Right. You're not even trying to do that. So I really want to get into this. I want to get okay. in it. I want to get so, in it. Yeah.
So let me use a few concepts from psychology and also people's experience who may be listening, that in some ways it's what people do in their free time as something they love. They do it to get out of the thought-based knowing and into a more awareness-based, interconnected, embodied, a type of flow consciousness. So I actually divide flow state into two types, which is kind of my own thing. One I call absorbed flow, where you enter into a very concentrated place or you're involved in a task and you look up and 2 hours have gone by. So I call that absorbed. And then the second is panoramic flow. So like a musician playing could be an absorbed flow, but if they're in an orchestra, they are aware of everyone in the orchestra that they're totally in tune with. They're aware of the audience. They're not self-referencing. They're using implicit memory rather than self-reference. They're in the now, which means time isn't being referenced. There's a sense of flow and there's an ecstasy or bliss in the activity itself. And they're not, you know, just like if you were typing, you don't think about typing, you just type. You're not using thought to remember the keys. You're in a kind of trusting awareness-based mode. So this kind of awareness is available, and people know it, but they don't know they know it because it's not on our psychological map.
Wow. You're not even aware of the process that you're going through to produce something?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
You're
so in it that you're not even aware of what you're doing?
And you're looking from it is why you can't see it. But you...
I mean, wow. Is this related to... Because you could take this to the extreme and it starts sounding crazy. Yeah. Like this woman who came up to you and said that she went to the supermarket and... And she doesn't remember shopping at all, but she just saw the basket and you asked, well, do you like the stuff that you picked? Is it like would you take it that far?
No, because that I think I even used as an example of somebody who's more spaced out than right. in awake consciousness. Yeah,
good.
That was the
example. Good.
That people come to me thinking they're in this. But they're not. No, it's more like, you know, so somebody like, let's say, I'll give you a couple examples. So let's say if anyone just you can use your imagination or memory, you just step out of your car and you're going to take a nice walk in the woods, step out of your car, you have activity, you close the car, you walk a couple feet, then you walk into the woods. As soon as you walk in, you drop. So your consciousness drops and opens and connects. And you just now are in this feeling that everyone knows when they're in nature of, you know, what you could call a peak experience, but I would call it an actual more natural state of consciousness rather than self-referencing or self-consciousness, where you're thinking about what am I doing next, where am I going, where you're identified with thought, you're in a spacious and pervasive interconnected, but you don't know. You just think, oh, the woods made me do it, you know, or you go on a walk with a friend and you laugh. Oh, it's the friends. So what I'm saying is that this is you can be happy for no reason without cause, that this awareness is here and can be intentionally accessed without a trigger or without a person, place, or thing that most people use as their doorway.
Can you access it on demand? Have you gotten to that point?
On demand, yeah.
I mean, how long, how many years do I have to practice this before I can access it on demand?
Okay, well, let's you ready to try it now?
I listened to your I did all your guided meditations that are on your website, and trying to really understand the what the experience is and how it differs from like other kind of meditations I've done. Yeah. So I'm really excited to do this with you right now. So I'm ready.
I'll say a little bit. I'll give the second part of the answer, which is that that this teacher who I met, Tulku Ergen, said there's two kinds of mindfulness: deliberate mindfulness and effortless mindfulness. So what you learned in MBSR and most types of mindfulness are deliberate. So use your attentional system to focus on your breath, and then you open to a mindful witness, and then you can look at contents of consciousness. But you're focused, you're pulling back the camera, you're focusing the camera of the small self, which actually, in terms of neuroscience, the research shows that what you're doing is you're putting on your task mode network of your brain, and you're repressing your default mode network. And the reason you get calm is because they're no longer alternating, but only one is on. So as soon as you get up, you're a little calmer, but then it just comes back again. And this research, same research, I can give you the study that studied this non-dual meditation. I was one of the subjects in with this guy, Joseph Povich, at NYU.
Oh, I know him. I was at NYU. He was a colleague of mine.
Zoran?
Yeah. He was a colleague of mine when I was at NYU.
So he did the study, and I was in the fMRI and did this kind of balanced awareness. What happens is the task mode network, which looks out, and the default mode network, which looks in and can go to daydream if it's not looking in, balance. So there's a feeling that you're seamless and you're equally aware inside and out.
And when you're complete aware sense. Inside,
yeah. And when you're aware inside and out, there's no problem. Everything is literally because you're aware, it feels like you're aware from a, you know, almost a field of awareness, the way that Andrew Newberg, you know, talked about the parietal lobe being less active, and you feel this sense of spaciousness, then you're aware from that spaciousness of your body inside and out, rather than just looking in at your thoughts from a detached mindful witness. You're actually opening and including in a more flow consciousness, which is the way a musician or an athlete, you know, a point guard on a basketball team is in the flow. He's equally aware inside and out, looking at the audience, the timing, knows the clock, knows where everyone's moving, looks one way and throws it the other way, and it goes, you know, perfectly. So it's highly functional, but relaxed and joyful.
I really like that. We're just to clarify, you're gonna do something live with me, right? A practice.
Yeah.
So before we do that, though, let's nerd out a little bit about the neuroscience work.
Good.
Because there's a lot of nuance there in the literature that I think doesn't get discussed in popular treatments of the neuroscience of meditation. So Andrew Newberg happens to be a friend and colleague of mine, and we have published papers together on the neuroscience of the creative brain.
Yes.
Like creative geniuses. This is when I worked at Penn with the Imagination Institute. I was scientific director of the Imagination Institute, and we did all these. We scanned the brains of all these like really imaginative people. And what's really interesting is that when you look at the brains of really really creative people when they're doing like creative tasks and even at rest, their default mode network is on call. I mean, the kinds of cognitions that come from the default mode network can be the greatest source of imagination and creativity. So what I really like the way you framed it. I like the way you framed it as this wonderful calm accessing and flow of the default mode network, as opposed to I've seen some other narratives put forward in saying that it's all about getting rid of it, like cutting it out of the brain.
and a lot of problems. Right?
Yeah. Like that's like the arch nemesis of meditation is the default mode network.
The default mode network and the ego. Those two.
Yeah,
gotta get rid of them.
Gotta get rid of them. And I've been really trying to argue that's a really short-sighted way of viewing the reality of the situation. And, you know, so anyway, I'm really glad. I just wanted to double click on that. I really like the way you phrase that. And just, you know, just to point out that research I did with Andrew, you know, showing that, or Andy, as we call him, that actually really creative people, they have great attentional flexibility. So they can be so flexible in knowing when it's task appropriate to activate it and when it's task appropriate to maybe inhibit the activity of the default. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other interesting thing is that shamatha, that way of creating calm abiding by doing one-pointed meditation, seems the research shows that it does repress the default mode network and just have, so it creates calm. So one of the sons of my teacher, Sogni Rinpoche, came to the United States and said, why is everyone doing stupid meditation? Because everyone was doing one-pointed meditation, calling it mindfulness and meditation. And what they're doing is you calm by repressing, and then you're very calm, and it lasts a while. And, you know, it's like a nap or a sauna or a, you know, it's good. It's not bad, but it doesn't. So then the other most recent study is the EEG, where mindfulness and one-pointedness, you go from beta to alpha. Mm-hmm. So you go from, you know, beta is kind of everyday mind, chattering mind, and you go to alpha, which is a calmer, quiet state. And then when you do this non-dual meditation, similar to what I'm doing, you actually get synchronized gamma. So synchronized gamma. So gamma, each blip of gamma is like an aha moment. And this is synchronized. So you get that creative mind, you get the calm. So the beta goes to alpha and then the synchronized gamma comes on. So you're joyous and alert and creative and related. And that's the differences in you know, kind of the neuroscience studies that, you know, deliberate mindfulness or basic mindfulness has very good, you know, qualities and effects, but it is it's traditionally a preliminary practice leading to effortless mindfulness, which is more about living a plateau experience.
Well, I wonder if we both have been kind of working on a very similar state of consciousness without you just calling it different, having different terms in a different tradition with different teachers, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know if I ever sent you my article for Scientific American on a skeptical scientist mindfulness journey. Did I ever send that article? The thing is that made me very skeptical of at least the kind of in the MBSR course, that kind of the controlled form of meditation, is that, like, my whole graduate work was a big chunk of it was with Jerome L. Singer, the father of daydreaming. He was my one of my advisors, and our work together was to show the benefits of daydreaming.
Sure.
The creative benefits of mind wandering. We distinguished between positive constructive daydreaming and inattentional control, which is a different, you know, you can have great executive control resources and still have positive constructive daydreaming. They're not at odds with each other.
That's right.
So, you know, as I say, you can be deeply focused on your daydreams. Why not? The thing that, you know, when I would go to this meditation, you know, MBSR, and they would say, if your mind wanders, if you're daydreaming, go back to your breath. And the rebel in me wanted to be like, you know, come on, like, sometimes my daydreams are good, you know, like, don't tell me to ignore them. So that was like, anyway, I just bring this up as just to give you a context.
So, you know, and you can see that it literally shows that you're putting on the task mode and you're repressing by doing that practice, which gives you an effect, but is it really an effect that is functionally helpful? I think it's restful, but ultimately it doesn't actually help you even go to the next level of mindfulness. And there's many other ways that I use now, where I use the polyvagal theory of working more with the nervous system, taking breath, breathing in, and then breathing out slower through the mouth, longer and slower. So you take the sympathetic nervous system and move to the parasympathetic. So you're calming the animal body, and then you let the mind kind of calm down, and then you shift to this awareness. So, it's just a different animal. And one of the meditations I actually do is, when your mind wanders, focus on your wandering mind and follow that as your object of meditation. And just stay with that, just as you did your breath. That's it. Just stay with it. Don't stop it. Just follow that wandering mind and just be attentive, or just be, you know, focused or curious about what's going on with that without analyzing or, you know, getting involved with the story. And then come back to your breath whenever the journey switches. So you follow it. And that is the alternate, you know, what's happening, you know, in this cycle of neuroscience is the brain is alternating these two systems of going task mode, looking out, then it looks in. So if you're trying to watch your breath, it will go in and your mind will wander because it's going to default mode. So follow it there and then follow it back. It's really interesting.
It seems to me like what you're teaching is actually very, very conducive to creativity and creative flow. I feel like I want to collaborate with you on linking explicitly your work to the work I've done in creative flow, because it seems now I can see it much more clearer now. So I'm really glad that we're having this conversation.
Yeah. And then Judd Brewer has a research paper on this gamma synchrony. So that'll show that it's more creative. I'll send you that.
Please do. Judd, I just spoke with Judd for the podcast, and okay, I actually back channel. I brought together a Zoom call with Judd and my creativity of neuroscience researchers to kind of talk about, get a conversation started on how we can integrate all these different findings in these different fields, like the creativity field and the mindfulness field. So I'm really interested in building those bridges. Yeah.
That's great. Good. So let me give a little prep for this this little practice. And you may have done it in, so the sense of what, you know, awake awareness or awareness-based knowing rather than thought-based knowing, which is both prior in a child, you know, it's not exactly primary process versus secondary process, but it's even just the consciousness of a child prior to developing conceptual thinking. And then so it's something that's awake and aware without using thought to have it, to be alert. So what happens then when secondary process thinking happens, we develop thoughts, and then at 1.5 to 3 years old, we develop what's called self-awareness in psychology, which is interesting because what that is the ability to look in a mirror when you have a mark on your nose and realize, oh, that's me. I'm aware of me. And that's the external version of it. But the internal version is something we all know well, but we're not aware of. You know, you better not say that. What are you going to do? Are you going to do this or are you going to do that? So who's the you that's talking to you? That's self-awareness that's aware of your thoughts. It's not mindfulness yet, but it's the way we operate. So that self-referencing that shows up in the PCC of the brain ends up creating this small separate sense of self that feels like it's in our head looking out of our eyes. Mm-hmm. So it's one kind of constellation of consciousness. And when that ego function that's supposed to function by saying, you know, what's going on out there? What's going on out here? Is there some danger there? Is there something I need to be aware of here? So it's trying to problem solve all the time. So the function is problem solving. We identify with it and we're always looking for a problem. So if that constellation of consciousness would relax, we might be able to almost have our awareness open the way Andrew Newberg, longtime meditators, open to this more spacious, alert, awake awareness. So the simple inquiry to understand with your mind and then to let your awareness feel is, what's here now when there's no problem to solve? So just understanding the words, letting the problem solver relax, and then let your awareness be aware of what's here. And then just curious, what's it like to rest as that which is here when there's no problem to solve?
I think I'm resting in that space right now.
Yeah.
As you went through that. And it's very interesting because it's I feel a little bit dumb.
Yeah. Well, it's the alternative to chattering mind.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the chattering mind or the ego is going to say, that's called dumb. Don't go there.
That was obviously a conceptual label, right? I put on it. After, but I did that after when I was trying to reflect on it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And it can't. So there is some kind of, so it's almost like you're moving from trying to clean up the cloud of your identity and you just let the problem solver relax and then open to the day sky. What's here now when there's no problem to solve? So it's restful. That's the calm. It's non-thought based, so it's not chattery or smart in the usual sense, but it is alert, right? And you could respond, but that's the question. What's it like to not orient to thought and yet be here? What's it like to not be, I think, therefore I am? What's it like to go into being?
Yeah. It seems like you associate love, you know, an open-heartedness to this kind of vast, expansive form of consciousness. And do you think that's going to be the case for everyone? Like, I'm so curious with if you had psychopaths do this practice, these are obvious questions, I think, but I think they're important questions, you know? Are there people who in their ordinary consciousness don't access the love state quite frequently at all, that you can do some practices with them that they can start to be like, oh, that's what that feels like?
I mean, I haven't had psychopaths, but I have had schizophrenic, bipolar, and interestingly, with people with complex trauma, you know, something I've, you know, explored with them. So these are people who really have not bonded and, you know, have a lot of early trauma. And I'll ask them, okay, is there a part of you, they'll even have suicidal thoughts, you know, is there a part of you that wants to hurt yourself? And they go, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I said, well, where is that? Well, it's like right here, my throat, like choking me. And is there a part of you that would like, has come here to kind of feel better or hope that there's some, well, I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess there's a little bit, you know, a little lower than that in my body. And then I'll ask, well, who's aware of those two parts? And they'll go, well, I am. And I'll say, well, where are you? Well, I'm the one that's aware of the other two parts of me, and I'm here. I'm like everywhere. I'm the real me, you know. So they'll open to this spacious, pervasive kind of, and it has this welcoming quality. So it's not like necessarily bliss love, but it's not a neutral. It can start neutral in the practices, like what's here now when there's no problem to solve. There can be kind of an alert awareness that's awake. But then if you ask, well, then what does it feel like to be aware from here of your body and the world? You'll start to kind of drop and feel this safety and connection. And once you feel the connection from the awareness-based knowing, so that it feels almost like an ocean and wave rather than a small separate self looking out of your eyes from the middle of your head that's constantly worried. You feel this non-fear, non-worry. So it's really what a peak experience is like. But you can, when you intentionally do it through this non-dual meditation, you start to learn what the consciousness constructs are, or what the station you're tuning into. So you tune out of that chattering mind or that emotional contraction into this more spacious and then embracing or pervasive, you know, open mind or open heart. And you just feel like you're something greater than yourself that is yourself. And so this can be done intentionally, and people are, you know, both in therapy and in meditation or in flow consciousness while you're walking or just doing an activity.
I hear you. And it just makes me think that, and this might sound a bit cheeky, but I think you'll really resonate with it. You know, it's funny, we use the word transcendence, but this feels like the opposite of transcendence. This feels like, and there's no word for that. Like, what is the exact descendence? Anyway, maybe that is what it is. Descendence. Yeah. You're descending. Yeah. I'm trying to grasp for a lexicon to describe this is, because it's not like you're, you know, transcending the ego. That's not the right narrative here. It's like you're descending into your being. It's like you're getting so much in touch with your being itself, like pure, like Maslow called it pure being.
So I mean, there are some terms of the, you know, transcend and include, or fully divine and fully human, or you know, in Tibet they say the inseparable pair of awareness and aliveness. So there's, you know, that's the magic move of this non-dual practice that isn't, so even a mindful witness, you know, that's just an open awareness that's watching things come and go, is a detached observer. It's not embodied. Mm-hmm. It's a separate witness consciousness, whereas this is embodied and interconnected. So that's the move. So I call it waking up from the ego, waking to the awake awareness, waking as the awareness and aliveness, and then waking in, and then waking out to create and relate. So it's a multiple. And if you only stop halfway, if you just transcend and stop at selflessness or no self, you may stumble into this, but you also, like Willoughby Britton's studies at Brown with people who are doing 5-day retreats, that she said something like 30 to 40% of them will get flooded by their unconscious. Because if you deconstruct without finding the solution, which is the awareness embodied true nature, so, you know, self with a capital S, then you've just taken away not only the ego, but the ego defenses.
Yeah, this is quite different than like witness consciousness, which is what, like, which is all the rage in a lot of these mindfulness training sessions. And I think the point here is not that, like, we're hating on that. That's not the point at all. It's that there's a step further that people might not be aware of. You know, that's funny to even say that, might not be aware of, but there's a step or a few steps further that can take you more into the I think really where you can really tap into your creative juices that are just so naturally there already. I really like this. I really do. Have you worked with people who suffer from ADD, you know, in the sense that they feel like they cannot, you know, they can't make decisions. They're paralyzed by their ability, their inability to make a decision, to concentrate on a task for more than a couple minutes, you know, in most extreme cases. Yes. You know, how do you work with these kinds of individuals using these approaches?
So I call it, instead of attention deficit disorder, I call it attention overload disorder. So in other words, they're trying so hard to use their attention to do it that it's overloaded. So So the thing is, the attention can't do it. So this method of non-dual mindfulness is upgrading to a spacious awareness. So you literally can feel like your awareness drops from thinking to seeing, and then goes to hearing, and then opens to this space in the room. And then the feeling is, all right, are you aware of the open view, or are you aware from the open view? And now can you focus on your breath, and can you focus on the keyboard? So while you're kind of still open and embodied and connected.
Of and versus from.
Yeah.
I understand the of, but okay, what's the from? What's the from?
So that's, you know, that is the peak. That's one of the markers of a peak experience. That's Andrew Newberg's marker for the Buddhist and the Christian is the parietal lobe relaxes from being aware from your body. And their feeling is that you're aware from an open mind or a flow consciousness, which is interconnected or is aware from, you know, a little more boundless feeling of where your mind is. So it just has a little more open mind, open heart, and you're aware from there. So you're not aware from this point of view in your head. You're kind of dropped, opened, and then aware from this kind of field or feeling. And it's what you feel when you walk into the woods or you, even when you drive a car, you can't drive from a pinpoint. I mean, you can. You see people doing it. They're like looking over, but you have
they
to
do it.
You have to. So one of my practices is to let your eyes rest and realize that hearing is receiving. Right, hearing sound comes from outside and comes to their ears, but seeing is also receiving. Light reflects off of objects and comes to your eyes.
Does this relate to the, you talk about local awareness. Yeah. Is this related to that? Yeah.
So the ADD practice is what, so that explains local awareness. So the spacious or awake awareness is when you shift the center from your thoughts to your seeing, to your hearing, to more spacious awareness. And now when you focus on your breath or a task, from awake awareness, you're not using attention. In fact, in flow consciousness, they talk about hypofrontality, which means when you're in flow, you're not using your frontal attentional system. You're using your whole, more of a whole brain. And it feels like, what it feels like is you're aware from an open, interconnected space. So what it is literally, maybe just, you know, the parietal lobe is less intense or it feels more open. But whatever that is, you don't have to explain it or what, you know, how can you be aware from an open space? It's like, what does it feel like? Oh, it feels vast or open or connected. Okay. So then you've just shifted your consciousness. And now focus from here on typing. Oh my God, people will say. So I've worked with kids with ADD. I have a little ADD. I've had it. I played sports and I did this. So receiving light in your eyes now. So then just let your eyes rest and receive. And then just don't move your eyes, but begin to open awareness up so that your peripheral vision starts to follow. Don't strain, but take your time. And breathe in and smile. Look up. So you get a little endorphins and you get this safety, which is when you're looking up, your brain is saying it's safe. Open your awareness up. And when it gets to the side, just let somehow your awareness continue around to the sides in which sound is coming, going. And then just somehow it feels like awareness continues around 360 degrees. So you feel like you've opened your view. And then you're aware as this open field of awareness that's equally inside and out and from this open awareness. And now when you focus on something, like your breath, you're not using attention, you're using local awareness, which just kind of makes it light up from the field. You're aware, it feels like you're aware from this open field of awareness, embodied awareness. And then your breath just, it's actually, you almost feel like you're aware from all around and from your stomach. When you're aware of your breath, you're not, you don't have to establish this attentional, dualistic point of view. And that's kind of the mystical, it's what Maslow has called the peaks.
Let's start linking a bunch of this to Maslow.
Okay.
Not just Maslow, but also, dare I say, Kaufman, because I have new stuff.
Oh, good.
There's a quote from Maslow. He says, "I think of the self-actualizing man not as an ordinary man with something added, but rather as the ordinary man with nothing taken away." Yeah. As you're talking, it seems like this is very much in line with his way of thinking about self-actualization. I keep going back to, it's like not transcendence. It's like,
right.
It's descendance,
descendance or inclusion or waking in rather than waking up.
Tuning in. But also unlearning, you know, it's like,
It's unlearning that secondary process thinking.
Yeah.
If that's you.
Well, even Freud would have liked this shit.
He had evenly hovering attention.
Yeah. I mean, you know, primary, secondary thought thinking.
This is tertiary process, is what I call it. So awake awareness is tertiary process knowing.
That makes a lot of sense. I like that. I really do like that. So let's link this to the plateau state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Because this is what Maslow, this was his unfinished symphony.
Yes.
And exactly. That I've been trying to take the baton and move forward.
I'm with you on this one. I love it.
So UA Asrani talked a lot about this state of consciousness. Now, many people have not heard of UA Asrani, but I think he's an East Indian mystic. Have you ever encountered him? Have you ever heard of him?
Yeah. I've heard of him. I remember reading him at one point, but I never studied him or.
Yeah, he's not as popular and well known, but Maslow was very captivated by his writings on the plateau experience, and so he co-opted that term. And I'd love to share with you. I have letters between the two whereas. He sends Asrani his papers on the plateau experience, and Asrani gives him like 40-point, you know, point by point critique, and it's just beautiful. It's beautiful dialogue that they had about this just in letters. But this state of consciousness is, you know, being able to see the miraculous in the everyday, and to kind of Maslow, he said it's like lounging in heaven, not getting so excited about it.
Right. That's right. It's heaven on earth.
Yeah.
It's as if you're not getting rid of anything. So pleasant and unpleasant experiences are just the human experience. And it becomes not about what's here, but what it's arising to. So what it's arising to is what changes. So nothing needs to be gotten rid of. Or taken away.
Right.
It's just you're shifting your view.
And this ties in so much with all my research on openness to experience it's a personality trait, but it's also a state. And this notion of Maslow called it newness of appreciation.
Right.
Being able to have gratitude for what you see it over and over again every single day, and constantly awakening to the newness of that. Right. It seems like all this is just so strongly tied to your project.
Here's my take on what the plateau, how the peak and the plateau differ, because a peak experience is almost like it's happening to you. So it's almost like a high. It could be drug induced. It could be love induced through sex or through intense state of nature. But the plateau means that the ground of being, or you've discovered the essential self that has its own natural qualities that can't be perturbed. So it's no longer, it's not a state, it's not even a trait, it's a stage, or it's actually even more of an identity, like your essential identity that's been revealed that you're now aware from. So first it would peek through, P-E-E-K, as, you know, as a kind of a moment, but then you realize, oh, it's just in the background, it's already installed, but it's covered over by this fast moving, you know, constellation of consciousness, ego-centeredness, secondary process, functioning. And then as soon as that relaxes, nothing needs to be gotten rid of, it just comes forward and its background becomes foreground and then becomes all ground.
I love it. And it's the only thing that's tripping me up here is you still use the word identity, like the identity. What does identity mean in that context? Because Maslow thought transcendence was a big part of it was transcending identity.
You know, this is kind of one of the more important things where normal psychology, Maslow, meditative consciousness, and non-dual theory can all meet. So, you know, so the normal psychology is either that there's an ego or a small center of self and that you're trying to make it healthy, a healthy ego. And, you know, you want work and love and functional, good life that's not overwhelmed by emotion and that, you know, lives in society. And then, but then the smarter you get, the more neurotic or the more anxious or the more uptight, or you end up in a role. You end up kind of shutting yourself. Well, hello there. Nice to see you. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm very successful. You know, like you get caught in some, either a tight role or too loose. You're either too much energy and you're anxious, or you've repressed too much and you're depressed because the small ego identity can't really handle a fully intimate human life. It's always kind of shutting the battery down or becoming a workaholic, or it's self-referencing so much it doesn't feel bliss or pleasure because it's, you know, can't get what it wants because it thinks it's out there, so it goes to addiction or, you know, something like that. So self-transcendence is an attempt to say, okay, the problem is this limited sense of identity. Okay, it's not what you're feeling, it's who's feeling it. So whether it's Maslow or Buddhism, so the first schools of Buddhism say, you know, we're going to deconstruct it and we're going to look and see that it actually isn't, there's no solid self, there's just thoughts, feelings, sensations coming and going. But then they don't say what else there is. So you end up sitting in a monastery watching your thoughts or you kid yourself, because once you get off the cushion, you have a calmer ego. But so that what Tibetan Buddhism and this North Indian Mahamudra says is, okay, there's the small self, then there's the no self, then there's the true nature. So there is an operating system that isn't the small self, but it's not just the absence. That it has actually, it relieves suffering and it reveals natural positive qualities. Mm-hmm. So that's the system that I'm working with. So even the way I do it myself and the way I teach my students is, let's not spend a lot of time deconstructing or in the transitional no self or selflessness. Step out and then into that which is wakes back in and is interconnected, and feel that. Now include your emotions or anything else or chattering mind, and what do you notice? And so the key for me is in self-transcendence or self-inclusion is you've got to have definition of what there is besides the small self. Otherwise, you end up just making them qualities of the small self. Oh, there's more joy. Oh, there's more awe. Oh, there's more. Oh, now I have more. Well, who does? Oh, is it that small self? No, I've transcended it. Well, then who are you, or where are you, or what are you? Oh, well, I transcended. I don't know. You know, so the Tibetan system is willing to say there is this nature of mind, this true nature, that does have a feeling that's spacious, pervasive, interconnected. And when you feel like it, you feel like, oh, this is me. This includes everything, and nothing's threatening. And yet I'm a unique individual, and I'm connected to everyone. And that's who I am. That's essentially who I am. And then I have imperfect stuff that's still coming up from childhood, or from, mm-hmm. you know, just not knowing stuff, or whatever emotions, you know, are happening based on who you are. But there's a new operating system rather than just the absence of the old.
But what's the identity there? What is the identity of that operating system?
So one of the metaphors is you are a wave in the ocean of reality. So there's a very unique individual here, but I'm connected through the ocean to everyone and everything. So I'm essentially...
Nice. It's like a sailboat metaphor, perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah, but you're not an individual sailboat that can sail.
I know.
But that's the key, is that you feel like you're this unique creation that has an expression and a shine and a sparkle to it. But it's not either or. That's the key. It's not, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, am I somebody or am I nobody? It's like, no, you are an individual, but you're not separate. So the word emptiness, which is often misunderstood or kind of defined in a limited way in Buddhism, mm-hmm. people say, oh, emptiness means there's no self, so you're empty. So it's like a void. But what the word means is that you're empty of a separate self nature. So it means that a tree, there's no such thing as a tree in itself without water, sun, earth, and air. So a tree is empty of being a separate self. Therefore, it's interdependent. Therefore, emptiness means interconnected.
Well, this is very, very, very relevant to the way I even define self-transcendence as more horizontal than vertical, you know. Yeah. That's definitely how I've been thinking about it. That's what I call healthy transcendence at the very least. But there's a lot of spiritual narcissism going around these days. I wrote an article about that as well. There's a lot of this I'm enlightened and you're not effect in psychology that can happen when someone has a certain amount of hours of practice. They start to think, I'm more awake than you are, you know?
The first premise is everyone's already awake. It's just we don't know it. So it's like a game of hide and seek.
Yeah.
And so the awakeness is our essential nature, and it's just covered over. And so you're not doing anything. If you happen to, you know, the awakeness happens to peek through and become more essential, you didn't do anything. You're not as special. You're just, you know, say, come on, let's play hide and seek. Come on out. So that's the feeling, is like, come on in the pool. The water's great. Let's go.
Yeah. There's so much a part of, you know, I'm hearing you and I'm saying, this makes complete sense, but then there's also the individual differences psychologist in me that's trying to see how we can integrate the idea that people's essential nature do differ from one person to the next in terms of their genetic temperament, in terms of their talents, in terms of their life background, their experiences, their memories. So, you know, where does that come into the fold? You know, I do think there's a domain generality, but also a domain specificity. There are things that make us unique. There are things that we can tap into, we tap into a universal nature for sure as well. Yeah. I think there's perhaps both.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's not either or. It's always both. And, you know, I mean, so part of, you know, that sense of what is the root of suffering, what's the existential root is the, is not realizing your plateau or your peak or your sense of universal nature that's here. It's like here, not, it's not universal, like, whoa, you know, like,
right.
It's this universal that's particular. And then each particular person is just, you know, they're just who they are. And then there's, you know, things, you know, to learn and to grow and to develop that need psychological help too, that can really be helpful.
I gotcha, Locke. I gotcha. Yeah. I think we should end our conversation today on this note, but with a caveat of to be continued.
Yes.
Because this is really elucidating for me. I think I get it. And I see its relevance to a lot of things. My brain is going to be brimming. I know that I'm probably not even going to sleep tonight because I'll be thinking about it, which is not the state that you're referring to. So I need to maybe do your guided meditation to get to bed. But no, I get it. But I also am a nerd, and I also do like to think deeply about things, even in an effortful way sometimes. Yeah. I think that the key here is to know, be able to have the capacity to tap into those, the beauty and riches of this pure being that we're talking about, and also know when maybe it's not the most appropriate time in one's life to tap into that,
or to tap into being and then do from being.
That's good
the thing
too.
You start to do from being, and then everything, you know, becomes like that. And, you know, when you bumble along at certain things, you're not so good at it, but it's better than beating yourself up, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, my head really is brimming. I'm thinking about lots of things. I'm thinking about, you said you apply this in your psychotherapy practice, and I'm trying to compare and contrast this versus like the CBT approach. I mean, maybe CBT is just going about it all wrong. It's like the opposite. It's going down a different alley.
It's different.
And it's, in a lot of ways, I think it's more in line with Stephen Hayes and his approach in acceptance and commitment therapy. Yeah. And it may be even some of Stephen's critiques. You know, if you ever get a chance, listen to him on my podcast, because he critiques CBT a little bit as a little too in your head, a little too cognitive, and saying like, well, why do you have to wait to change, you know, your thoughts and all this when you can just tap into what's already there? And I think that that's in a lot of ways similar to some of what you're saying. So look, Locke, I just really appreciate you coming to my podcast today. And like I said, to be continued, because you brought up a lot of stuff.
I think we're on the same, you know, adventure together. And I think we can help each other and bring a lot of this languaging together of our different experiences.
For sure.
Great.
Thanks, Locke.
All right. Thanks so much, Scott. Great to see you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.